You're listening to Soldanela, Four Notes from a Native Daughter, with guest Alina Migoni.
No, thank you. I'm still thinking about, you know, Nalak. You're all very present to me, and you most certainly are, which is why I called you first, as I said I would, because I care. I really love the work of a librarian, and I love what it means. Did you ever read that little series, children's books by Madeline Lowry? I'm mixing names right now. I can't believe I'm being so dyslexic, but it's called The Giver.
Yeah, Lois Lowry.
Mm-hmm. Lois Lowry. To me, librarians are like the giver, but yeah, in a perverse kind of way, right? Like, I was thinking of a metaphor. I always like to look for metaphors. And to me, that's like, that's kind of what you mean. That's kind of what you are. Mm-hmm. You're the keeper of memories. And I guess, you know, we're not born librarians. So when I think of Alina Migoni, I'm like, how did you come to decide or love research, preservation, support, you know, in thinking about those categories that the law says that folk art is so important, but there's this whole story that precedes that. So when I connect it to the times, it's so important what you do, right? Like preserve, protect, disseminate. Like, how do you come to want to do that? And not just your job at the library, but in the general sense as a profession, obviously. We can start with that.
Okay. So I think I really liked your liking it to The Giver, because that is very much like an intuitive observation of yours, where most people think of librarianship as gatekeeping, without the emotional responsibility, without the ethics behind what it is we're doing. And so many people don't realize, one, that there's a level of education to go into this profession.
Level of education.
Yeah, and you know, that can be kind of hurtful when you're in the profession, to think that people may not know what it is you do. But apart from that, I think it isn't just gatekeeping. It's not just knowing where a book is and pulling it off the shelf. It really is a calling. It's a calling to want to help others and enable others to follow their educational paths, their artistic paths, their creative paths. But it also, for me, it's about bearing witness, which is why I think the giver metaphor is so apt, because I was actually drawn to librarianship, strangely enough, because I wanted to write books. I didn't really want it to be the person who looked up books or organized them. I, as a child, always wanted to write history textbooks, and I wanted to write them in innovative ways. I wanted it to be non-traditional formats. I wanted them to be tactile. I always thought that's what I was going to do. I was going to introduce a 3D, you know, multisensory type of textbook that had to do with Latinx history, especially Mexican American history, especially immigrant history in the U.S. I felt like what I was learning at home, coming from San Diego and coming from a kind of transnational family. Some of my family still live in Mexico, and I constantly cross the border to visit them. Everything I was learning at home was not reflected in my textbooks. It wasn't reflected by the conversations I was having at school as a young child. I had no idea that there was this much hurt and pain in our communities, because it was never presented, you know. I didn't know about systemic racism. I didn't know about these things that have, you know, plagued our communities. And so when I first realized that when I was 12 or 13, I thought, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to write books. So as an undergraduate, I went to Peru and I did a study abroad opportunity and focused on social justice and looking at globalization and the impact of globalization, neoliberalism on indigenous communities. So I did a whole bunch of homestays. I actually spent a month on my own in Iquitos in Peru doing oral history work with educators. Again, I thought I was going to somehow, you know, tap into the education system. And my question to everyone I interviewed was, how do you present the history of colonization? And that was it. That was just, what does that mean to you? And so I went to school in Iquitos specifically for indigenous educators who traveled, you know, days by boat, and they lived at the school because educators in Peru are assigned, and nobody wants to go to the Amazon if you're from the Andes or from the cities. And so they kind of had to educate themselves and be their own, you know, support system and infrastructure. And I talked to professors at the institutions in Iquitos, and it just became clear that there's this grave injustice. What's being held in our archives and the histories being told are not being told in, you know, these quote unquote real authoritative ways. And so I did some work on their request. I went to an archive and I just saw all these records and photographs of people who've been enslaved and killed in Peru. And it just kind of hit me that this was my calling. It wasn't to write the book. It wasn't to be a children's author, which I had been going to like children's author events and trying to hone those skills. It was to be an archivist, and it was to deal with human rights abuses, because that was what the heart of the matter was my entire life. I just didn't know in those words, you know, what it meant. So I pivoted. I applied for Teach for America. And the last step, I didn't get it. And one of my professors said, like, that's the best thing to have ever happened to you. That's the absolute best thing to have ever happened to you, to not become an educator through Teach for America. That's, you know, and he had his whole spiel of how it's actually a disservice for, you know, communities of color and all these things that I hadn't even taken into account. And I took a year off and I applied for library school. It was just, it all clicked. And the irony of it, this is a long story. So the irony of it is that my mother has worked at UCSD in the library since I was 12 years old, 11 years old. And I never once considered being a librarian. Like all of the family friends, all of my mentors growing up were librarians. And I lived in the library because my mother is, I'm first generation college student or attendant. And so she didn't have, and she's a single mother. We didn't really have money for camps and after school programs unless they were free or subsidized. And so I spent summers in the library just hanging out with adults far older than myself who were teaching me about classic film. And she worked in the arts libraries, an art and architecture library. And so everyone I was around were these creatives who just, you know, had also this calling and this passion for their collections. They made the conscious decision to become art and architecture librarians or film preservationists or what, you know, what have you. And it just never clicked. I always was like, well, that's great for you. And that sounds fun. I watch a lot of movies. It just never meant anything to me as a child. It wasn't until this kind of abroad experience where I realized the societal impact of librarianship and archivist training, I realized that you could save lives with record keeping and bearing witness. Yeah. And it's not about knowing where on the shelf something is. It's about making sure that you connect communities with resources. And so that's how it all started.
And where did you go to library school?
So I did a dual master's at UCLA. So I did a simultaneous degree in library and information science with my Latin American studies degree. So there was a lot of commingling and conversation between the two disciplines for me.
And then what happens once you graduate? Like, how did you begin the path?
When I was in grad school, I pretty much made it clear to my professors I wanted to do human rights work. So I had two professors who like took me under their wing and mentored me. And one does the rights work in the Balkans, and the other one works with South Asian communities. And I just kind of spoke with them, and I decided to do a whole bunch of internships. So I actually cold called people in DC while I was living in LA. I literally would look up people's names and directories at federal agencies, and I just called people. And I said, do you have volunteer situations? I know that paid internships are like one in a million. And I applied and I called enough people that I ended up working at the Department of Justice, the National Archives, and the Library of Congress all in one summer. Because I overcommitted myself, which is in retrospect a stupid thing to have done. But at the time, that was like my initial stage of working at the Library of Congress, was doing an internship, an unpaid volunteer position, cataloging resources for Mexico, Caribbean, and Central America. And I just learned about kind of the machinations of the library, that I knew it was big. I knew it was, you know, the world's biggest library. I just didn't realize the thousands of books that come from each country a day, and how much I couldn't wrap my mind around 170 million items. But now that, you know, I did the internship and I found a mentor there, and she kept me in the back of her mind. She knew I really liked the work. She knew that I was, every single day, I was taking a bus or a shuttle to some other part of the city to try to do another internship. And so a year later, when I was about to graduate, she called me and she said, hey, I'm a supervisor now, and a position's opened up in my section. She couldn't say more than that for, you know, ethics purposes, but she just kind of gave me a nudge and said, like, I think you'd like this. So, that's how I came to the library, just forcing my way in, making space.
And lucky for us.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, thank you.
I think my respect for archiving and librarianship and comes from like having experiences as a researcher for documentaries. I loved it when I did it. I've done it 3 times. And I didn't know that I was going to love it. That was the surprise for me. I was like, oh my God, this is like a beauty. This is so poetic. And it's obviously, you know, underrated, right? It doesn't really get, I think, credit it should, as I suppose teachers and other dependable jobs. That's an amazing story. I love that. You know, like you worked your way in. From what you're saying, it's like an intermix of what you discovered along the way, educating yourself, and you're like, oh my God, I gotta do this.
Yeah, it felt like a calling for sure. But at the time in grad school, I wrote, like, one of the mentors I spoke on, she brought me in and actually asked me if I wanted to do a project for a class of hers with the Cesar Chavez. Sorry, I just forgot this. It's a very obvious name, the Cesar Chavez Center. And she said, you know, they need people to help with their archive. And so I made a deed of gift, and I looked up forms and templates, and I gave them kind of a starter set of things that they would need to, in order to get oral histories and ask for permissions for usage, for former activists and current activists and their materials. And she basically showed me that there are institutions, there are cultural icons, there are people who've changed the world who need archives. And there are people who still are working the struggle and this fight. And I, so from that experience, I always thought I was going to go to a small community archive. I thought I was going to work, you know, in a team of three people, you know, fighting in the streets, trying to get, you know, trying to get our stories told. And the other mentor I spoke on, so the first was Professor Ann Gilliland, and the second, Professor Michelle Caswell, she invited me to be a research assistant for her. And we did work across Southern California at 17, I believe, community archives. So historical societies, again, these small, you know, maybe 3 to 30 people organizations, doing amazing work with what we called kind of disenfranchised or marginalized groups. So either marginalized ethnic wise or, gender and sexuality identities, or even labor movement archives. So kind of these subversive, quote unquote, groups, and just showing the importance of those who create their own documents and archive their own documents and retain their histories. It doesn't have to be done by a large institution. It doesn't have to be done at the federal level. It's actually very powerful for people to own and tell their own stories without an interloper coming in. So I published with her, and I just, again, I thought this is what I was meant to do. So the internship at the library was more for me to grow and to learn that first summer. The second summer, I actually applied for a paid internship and went back to the library. So I wasn't expecting someone to reach out to me and say, hey, do you want a federal job? Do you want to be with a pension? Like, do you want to come in and join the federal workforce? So it was kind of a moment in time where I made the decision to go to a larger institution and see what I could stir up there. When this entire time I thought I was going to be working on the border doing, you know, human rights documentation. So it felt...
But you are doing human rights documentation.
Yeah. At this point, I'm learning that that's what I'm doing and what I can do. But graduating, I had no idea. I was at a crossroads and I had no idea if I was doing the right thing.
Yeah. That's amazing, Alina. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
So Mama and Papa and your family, they're super proud.
Yeah. Everyone's still in San Diego or they're in Ensenada. And they miss me for sure, but I don't think no one has ever told me not to do something or has held me back. I think from a very young age, I showed that I was on my own path and I wasn't going to take no for an answer. So they're very much like, they're proud.
Yeah. 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 That's amazing. And so now you're there in the largest library in the world. Or some of your favorite collections or projects that you worked in, because it's hard to, right? You're probably doing so many, interacting with so many projects and people. One thing that I was kind of really attracted to and to ask you about, I wanted to learn more about this difference between veterans, history, occupational folk life, public folklore, narrative and verbal arts, public folklore, material culture, vernacular religious culture. Like, I mean, these are very nuanced areas. What are they? Because in a way, they're the same but different hues of.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. So last year I transitioned from my previous team. I now work at the American Folklife Center. And what you just described are different aspects to our collection development policy. And so the American Folklife Center has been tasked by Congress in law to preserve and present American culture. And so culture, we all know that there's no definition really. Obviously I studied as a cultural anthropologist, so there's a definition of the word. But there's no clear-cut line of quote-unquote American culture, because we're a country of immigrants, we're a country of indigenous populations, we're a country where those two identities meet and clash, and And we're still trying to navigate what it means to be American. People are dehumanizing each other, or they're denying access to identities. And so this is, this collection, like you mentioned, includes different aspects of how culture is created and disseminated. So occupational folk life, we do some grants or yearly fellowships where people do documentation with an occupation. Either they travel and they do photo documentation or interviews with people in a general region. So hairdressers of the southern states, for instance, or they could do a case study in a specific venue. So a fishery or a cannery and the culture that's created along the lines of occupation. But we have close to 1 million photographs from documentation from all around the world. We also have recorded sound dating back from the late 19th century to present day. We're the repository for StoryCorps, where anyone can download on their app and interview each other, oral histories. And so I guess back to your question, if I'm trying, these parts of collection development are guidelines for us find and collect and preserve and present materials of any format, audiovisual or manuscript, or born digital materials that present culture. So for instance, we have a web archive of memes, it's the web archive for online cultures or web cultures. So we have captured snapshots in time of different websites that you would think of as an example of a culture. So we've captured Urban Dictionary, and you can see what Urban Dictionary looked like on a specific day, 2 years ago. What did it say was the top searched word? And so these are just examples of what we collect. It's not all just sit down, I need to do an oral history, tell me about where you come from. It's all formats, all walks of life.
What's on your desk that you're shaping?
So on my digital desk now, I'm doing work for a couple of different web archives, actually, now that I'm on that topic. So one is the collection for Protest Against Racism, the protest and anti-racist movement in light of George Floyd's death that has been gaining traction, but is also historically tied to, so many movements before it. And so we're trying to capture websites and ephemera that's born digital content to show this moment in time and to give it space and in our collection as an important, how would I say this? To give it space in the collection for what it is, an important documentation of history and a turning point in our society. So that's kind of what I'm working through now, nominating websites while also taking into ethics behind capturing online content, because we're trying to do it in an ethical manner where we're not outing activists. We're not trying to find websites that may be used for punitive actions in the future. We don't want to continue a cycle of violence. And so that's really what's on my mind right now. We're also doing a web archive for COVID or coronavirus, web cultures and understanding of what is happening around the world. So not just in the US, we're capturing websites from all around the world that are either going to help researchers later on to think, what was it like to live through this pandemic? What did it feel like? What were the conversations and stories that were happening online? As well as bearing witness to the type of education or misinformation or miseducation happening online as well around the pandemic. And then physically at my desk, I went in this week, I have a real soft spot for our Garzoneda collection from Latin America. So this last year, the library had been buying Garzonedas for years. But we were able to transfer them all over to the American Folklife Center for its archive as a example of culture. from various countries. So I'm really happy with that collection. It's interesting because every single one is its own work of art. They're all individually handmade. I love the connection to Latin American feminist movements and that they're mutual aid organizations who are behind some of these bigger publishing houses, quote unquote, for Garfunera. So that's something that's near and dear to my heart.
So is it it's a pleasure for you, I mean, in a sense, to wake up and know that you get to do a task that serves the preservation of society. And back again to that idea of the giver and, you know, in Gathering Blue, that whole like patience of this young girl to learn how to create that color and everything that goes into it. It's sort of like, I swear to God, when I saw your presentation, I was like, oh my God, this is like the giver. It's like learning how to like collect and that struggle that we have now between people that don't want to remember or want to obviously erase fire, you know, Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
Vonnegut. But so to me, it's dear to my heart that, you know, like someone like you is inside that has all of these connections to struggle, to Chicano history. And that's really important. I hope you know that.
It's definitely like a heavy responsibility. I applied knowing that there were some shoes that I had to fill, you know, that a colleague of mine at this, Judith Gray, she's been working with Native populations across the U.S. and for 3 decades. She has been such a strong person and such a strong mentor for me because she cares for the materials and the sacred materials that are at the AFC. And she always puts the communities first. She's always on the forefront saying, like when people are asking to see resources, she's always saying, have you asked the tribal, you know, authorities and elders? Have you looked into what this means? Have you gotten the permissions? Are you part of the group of people who are allowed to see this? And so seeing just how delicately she cares about these documents. And that she has always brought the human element back. It's been really important for me to witness and to know that while I'm not at that level yet, like I need to instill those same values. I need to be a person who brings the community first and who thinks about the respect that needs to be maintained between the creators or the people portrayed in our collection versus people who would like to use or see or research. And it's not just kind of mindless intake. It's not both for collecting and for the researcher. You can't just take and without understanding where these items came from. And some of them do have very painful histories.
Of course.
So it's this mindfulness. So when being part of it, I can feel this like weight on my shoulders. And sometimes it's scarier than other days. Sometimes it weighs more heavily on my mind, but I want to make sure that I'm not a gatekeeper per se, but I'm a caretaker or caregiver, you know?
Yeah. I love it. Will you write a book, let's say?
So I would love to write a book. I'd love to kind of retrace my steps and go back to figuring out how to present what I've learned to others. I think something that the ego that I might have had as a high schooler or as an undergraduate, I've learned in library school and working with an archive and working as a librarian. It's not so much about the glory of one. It's not about my self-satisfying, you know, satisfaction of producing something. I've learned that I have a specific skill set, and that if I can enable others and I can be a person to help them get to their goals, I think that's what I want to achieve. I want to see if there's a next step from what I'm doing now to do social justice work and to do activism from behind the confines of my cubicle, you know. And I don't know exactly what that looks like yet. I could talk about the work I'm doing with Reforma, or that's like my first step, my first toe dipped into this kind of collaborative, community-oriented work I hope to do. And then, yeah, I do want to write a book. I want to go back to school. I want to get my doctorate. I want to shove it in everyone's face that I did it. Because I do have a really painful story. I was admitted to a doctoral cohort and I was pushed out, before it began because of my ethnicity and because I am the child of a single parent, because I'm a first generation college student. I was basically, I was forced out of the doctoral cohort, by the administration. So that is like, that's my life goal, to go back and to show people I left for something better, and I left for my life's passion, and I'm where I want to be. But maybe later I'll go back and just get the piece of paper just to shut them up too.
I hope you do. I know you will.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think this kind of holds together a little bit of, you know, A, what you do, who, you know, B, who you are, and 3, the importance of, you know, caregivers of culture and arts and folk life, and really all kinds of historical preservation. I mean, it's so important, and we see the reasons now, mm-hmm. you know, because if we didn't have people like you before, the emperors could just create whatever they want.
Well, yeah, that's
even with history, they're creating whatever they want.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like what you say is true, you know, and that's why I'm so passionate, because if there isn't a record and there didn't happen, you know, and if the records have been adjusted, if they've been erased, if they've been censored, if they've been rewritten, did it really happen? And who's to say? And, you know, we always say history is written by the victors, but I feel like archives are inherently biased. They were created by European, you know, Eurocentric Western ideologies. They were created with the understanding that there was one religion, you know, there. And so I am working in an oppressive system. I am working with, you know, hundreds of years of colonial damages, and not to mention the new neoliberal push to go out and to document others and to bring back and to conquer, you know, and to salvage, quote unquote, pieces of culture from others where that wasn't necessary and that was actually very much exploitative. So I do have a lot of qualms, not with the library, but with librarianship in general. I do have a lot of qualms with the state of librarianship, where we work as caregivers, but we also work as, you know, social workers. We have to know about psychology of others. We have to be open and honest and caring. And we also have to think about the people and the patrons and that are in our buildings and protect them. But we also have to protect the rights of those who've created documents. And so there's just a lot going on behind the scenes when we're making these decisions of what to buy, what to throw out, how to catalog it, what the metadata schema is that we're using. I mean, there are some really hurtful terms in our classification systems that are outdated or are just, you know, just not correct, politically, socially, ethically. And we're beholden to them because that's how you organize. And that's the law. That's, you know, that's the rules. So it's kind of you're doing two things. You're building the castle, you're building the organization, but you're also dismantling it from the inside. So it's, I love it. There's tension and there's passion, and you would never think being a librarian, you feel like you're changing, you know, the world for the better, but I feel it sometimes.
I think you are. I concur.
Thank you.
Which is the point of my wanting to talk to you, especially in relation to now, especially as, you know, the stakes are so high on defending the voices of the unheard, that, you know, we are so many and it's been so long. So I acknowledge you. Thank you. Thank you for what you do. Thank you. Thank you for being so tenacious and like going for it, you know, like trying to, because I think that, you know, when you said that you were like cold calling, I've done that too. And I actually, through that cold calling, I've gotten some pretty good gigs and I'm like jaw dropping. And so that thrust forward, you know, that like, oh my God, what can I do to like, because it's innocent, right? You say ego. I don't know about ego. Yeah, sure, there's ego in it, but there's also like
innocence
to it, you know, where you're like, oh my God, how do I get more experience? How am I going to do this? But, you know, then you have this wherewithal that you're like, well, let me call. Let me see who will answer my call. Like it seems so one-on-one, and yet the system has made us feel like a little bit intimidated, but, you know, to do that.
Yeah.
When we do that, it's, look at where it got you.
Yeah. I agree though, what you're saying about the system, it was kind of insane when I did it. And I felt like my peers, I didn't really talk about it with my peers because I didn't know how to. I didn't know how to say like, there are many doors I need to break down. And we were all feeling the same way, especially the other students, you know, students of color. And it felt like in this world, we're told to act a certain way. We're told that if there are positions, you have to apply and you have to be nice and you have to wait your turn. And I'm realizing like none of these institutions were built for me or for them or for us. So I'm not going to play by these rules. I'm going to ask, and I'm going to see if I can find someone who has also gone through something similar and can give me some tips. You know, I've had to rely on so many mentors in my life, and I've had to be humble and understand that I really didn't know anything going into college. You know, nobody in my family had gone to college. I didn't know how I was going to be perceived. Same thing for the workforce. I didn't know what it was going to be like in graduate school. I didn't know what it was going to be like as a federal employee. So, I just had to call people and ask.
I'm so delighted that, you know, you've broken barriers. I'm happy for you that you're doing this for yourself and then for a larger cause. I loved your presentation. You know, like I said, it was like the moving part of when I realized like what you did and everything just touched me so in a really special way. Very personal to me, what you do. And as I was saying before, in relation to what's happening now, it's more than ever, you know, I feel like you need to be protected. And when I mean you, I mean your tribe of librarians that are doing, you know, especially folk life work across the country and across the world. Because, you know, there are workers like you, cultural workers all across, you know, in Africa, in the Middle East, in Asia, in Europe, Latin America, of course, El Caribe. So my respects, my love, and admiration.
Thank you. I mean, it's kind of surreal to hear that from you, because I do, you know, learning so much about you and your work, I always kind of fall into the trap of comparing myself with others. And I feel like you've done such beautiful work and brought such beautiful art into society, into history, that, yeah, it's, I also want to acknowledge your compliments, because it's very difficult for me to hear compliments of this, because I don't talk about it often. I don't really leave my circle where we're all doing the same thing. And I don't think I've taken into account what it is that we're doing and how other people perceive it. So it's really moving for me to hear what you just said. And I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. It comes from the heart. We're equal. We're equal.
But to see what the beautiful work that's being done across the country with people who are so like-minded, like you said, right now, this is a time where we have to not only make room for ourselves, but like we have to keep the room that we've already made from being stolen. And we have to be defensive and offensive on the same time. We have to navigate these, you know, politics of identity and respectability. So like you said, when we were speaking earlier about, am I too loud or am I too aggressive or am I gracious enough and graceful enough? And it's like, no, this is the time to fight. You know, people can be elegant and gracious and they can fight in their own way. But if you need to ring the bell and you need to, you know, you need to be the person out there, you know, with the grito para, you know, everyone else, like, then that's how revolutions get started. And that's how revolutions continue to have the spirit and the morale. And so there's no reason to self-police. Like, people are already policing us. Like, we don't, you know, we need to just stand our ground and stand in our truth and work together. So that's what I think. And the Institute really showed me last week. And just speaking with you in general.
Peace on earth. Thank you so much, Alina. Un beso, un abrazo.
Yeti, I hope you're doing well. I hope, you're safe and sound and healthy.
I am. And we'll
your loved ones are.
We'll continue to talk.
Yes.
I'm grateful.